If you had to choose, which politician of the last 10 years would you give the prize to for telling the biggest lies? Tough to choose, whether it's special operations, stolen elections, or empty assurances written on the side of campaign buses. Truth becomes the first casualty of the thirst for power. So justice is driven back and righteousness stands at a distance. Truth has stumbled in the streets. Honesty cannot enter. Truth is nowhere to be found. Isaiah chapter 9, 14 to 15. Although it was written around the 8th century BC, that's 2,800 years ago, give or take, the struggle for truth to be heard persists. And that struggle plays a big role in our world. Commentators on our time reckon that we now live in a post-truth society. Indeed, the adjective post-truth was the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year as far back as 2016. It relates to circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than emotional appeals. Caspar Gratfold, the president of Oxford Dictionaries, said that the term post-truth's rocketing popularity is fueled by the rise of social media as a news source and a growing distrust of facts offered up by the establishment. He suggests that it will become one of the defining words of our time. Well, we read the news, we watch the television, and we've come to realise that, as one political analyst puts it, in this era of post-truth politics, an unhesitating liar can be king. The more brazen his dishonesty, the less he minds being caught with his pants on fire, the more he can prosper. And those silly old fussy pedants, still hung up on facts and evidence and all that boring stuff, are left for dust, their boots barely laced while the lie has spread halfway around the world. The disturbing phenomenon of fake news has arrived at our door and taken up residence. Fake news are those news stories that are simply false. The story itself is fabricated with no verifiable facts, sources or quotes. Sometimes these stories may be propaganda that is intentionally designed to mislead the reader, or maybe designed as clickbait written for economic incentives, where the writer profits on the number of people who click on the story. And the more fantastical, the more clicks, the more money. In recent years, fake news stories have proliferated via social media, partly because they are so easily and quickly shared online. So corrosive is this trend that the New York Times itself felt the need to offer this high-minded mission statement about truth in an advert printed on February 26, 2017, the truth is hard, the truth is hidden, the truth must be pursued, the truth is hard to hear, the truth is really simple, the truth isn't so obvious, the truth is necessary, the truth cannot be glossed over, the truth has no agenda, the truth cannot be manufactured, the truth doesn't take sides, the truth isn't red or blue. The truth is hard to accept. The truth pulls no punches. The truth is powerful. The truth is under attack. The truth is worth defending. The truth requires taking a stand. The truth is more important now than ever. Of course, fake news is not always created with an obvious agenda. Often on social media, especially following an atrocity or disaster, it's merely careless, unverified reporting, which quickly spreads, embraced and forwarded by a gullible public. Well, I don't want to be gullible. I don't want to end up like the Queen in Alice Through the Looking Glass, able to believe six impossible things before breakfast. I treasure and count sacred sharpness of mind, the intellectual incisiveness to sniff out the fake in individuals, the insight and judgment to figure out who's being straight and who's trying to con you, the ability to spot a fraud, detect a hypocrite, the ability to make sound judgment on these so-called TV documentaries that aspire to make their case with academic rigour, but are in fact more usually just demonstrations of slack thinking and inadequate argumentation. There are plenty of those to choose from. Shock value. I value the tutors and professors over the years who insisted on academic work being done with thoroughness and with intellectual rigour. No padding, no shortcuts, no imbalances, proper and demanding intellectual discipline. And I appreciate it when that same discipline is brought to the production of sermons, and that where preaching threatens to slide into careless thought and arrive at inadequately argued conclusions, then amber lights will flash and we will insist on logic, coherence and integrity of thought. I can't say how important it is to me to be able to consider critically ideas and ideology that don't make the difference between truth and falsehood. It's important to ferret out the inconsistencies, to challenge the blatant holes and the threadbare patches. To challenge the blatant holes and the threadbare patches in a politician's or an ideologue's thinking. And I especially place great store on good thinking when it comes to challenging bad theology. So-called Christian teaching that is biased, unprincipled, unloving, faux pious, and just plain wrong. The responsibility on us to do that, ask those questions, is considerable, for there are all kinds and varieties of bad thinking out there. And even if a lot of people are lazy, casual and naive in their thought processes, we Christians should not be. Fascinating new statistics have emerged on what people believe and how much more they believe than they used to. BBC News announced that a survey of over 2,000 people revealed that 55% believe in heaven, 53% in the existence of the soul, nearly 4 in 10 people believe in ghosts, and a further 22% believe in astrology and horoscopes, while 15% believe in fortune-telling and tarot cards. The think tank Theos said, "The findings were particularly striking because when compared to statistics from 1951, back then, only 10% of the public told Gallup that they believed in ghosts, and only 7% in 1951 believed in predicting the future by cards, and 6% by the stars." The thing is, I don't want people to believe more things than they used to, especially if they're not thinking properly about why they should or shouldn't believe those things. I applaud an appropriate scepticism. I like Thomas and his doubts, his suitable scepticism. I reserve the right to offer that disbelieving Dunbar doubter's ultimate put-down. Aye, right, I dinna think so. There is a healthy scepticism that asks good, hard, necessary questions and seeks and demands sound and convincing arguments and answers. We are not called to be gullible when we are invited to be believers. Stupidity is not a requirement for the man or woman of faith. We are required to have open minds. We are required to have open minds, and these are not always around in great numbers. People often fail to recognise that if they insist on only seeing the world through the lens of a materialist viewpoint, that they're not always going to be aware of the extent to which that very narrow perspective can blind them to the truth when it stares them in the face. Jaundiced attitudes can block our view of reality because of the narrowness of our minds and the stubbornness of our refusal to think outside our own predispositions and restricted categories, so that we start to define what can and cannot be, rather than letting what is in fact the case be the determining factor. What might seem like rigorous modern thinking can sometimes simply be pride and prejudice at work. John Polkingham, the former professor of mathematics at Cambridge, offers this warning. "If being a scientist teaches you anything, it is surely that the world is surprising, often behaving in strange ways that we could not have anticipated. This means that the instinctive question for a scientist to ask is not, is it reasonable, as if we knew beforehand the shape that rationality had to take. But what makes you think that this might be the case? That's a question at once more open and more demanding. It doesn't specify beforehand the form that an acceptable answer has to take. Science, says Polkingham, trades in the search for truth, attainable through motivated belief. Too limited a view of the ways in which reality can come to us, and the stubborn refusal to consider possibilities outside the limited frame of human calculations and measures, can thwart the approach of truth to our minds and cramp our capacity to embrace it. Keeping an open mind is of the essence of good thinking. And I resent the patronising, pitying tone of those who assume or imply that because I am a Christian, I am therefore surely a believer in childish fables, or have in some way allowed myself to be duped. One of my children expressed impatience and surprise that ministers spend so long at university. And why is doing a degree in something other than theology for a minister in training anything other than just a waste of time? Why not just do divinity and get on with the job? The Church of Scotland has always valued the fact that its ministers have been exposed to the challenge of serious thought in other disciplines, with the purpose of generating awareness, facing the intellectual challenge of other ways of thinking, other worldviews. So we need to read Plato and Shakespeare and Marx and Freud. We're required to encounter the alternative lifestyle options of Marcuse and D.H. Lawrence, David Hume and Jung, not to take refuge in the special pleading and safe place of those who think the same as we do. I certainly thank God for the power of rationality, the ability to think critically, to question, to use intellectual discernment, and to know what sound thinking looks like. And also to have the understanding to be aware of the dangers of too narrow and precious a frame of reference. As Christians, no less than anyone else, we are invited to ask for, to demand, to insist upon, and to love coherence, consistency, and effectiveness in the ideas we lay claim to. This is certainly part of what keeps me being a Christian, that at no time am I required to think inauthentically in order to believe, never asked to allow my standards of rationality to be sacrificed on the altar of blind obedience. No intellectual contortions are necessary, no suicide of the rational mind insisted upon by the demands for creedal correctness. No six impossible things to believe before breakfast. I am required to broaden my thinking in order to incorporate larger, grander categories, to find a wider perspective, clearer definitions that allow reality to speak, rather than those that circumscribe what's possible. Let what is be the final arbiter of truth. Thomas, in the passage we read, is absolutely right to be sceptical, just as he's right to be brave enough and honest enough to adjust his definitions and shift the boundaries of his prejudices in the light of this new reality that encounters him, the risen Christ. And the gospel writer is absolutely on the ball when he recognises that actually not many will have it as good as Thomas. If the gospel is to travel the world and new people be drawn to Christ, it will not be because, like Thomas, they saw him, touched him, fell on their knees before his risen presence, placed their finger in the fresh wounds of Calvary. Faith for the multitudes of Christians yet to come, John knows, will not come from this kind of dramatic encounter with a vivid reality of the risen Lord there in front of us. For us, it comes from somewhere else. Something else. And you will know what that something else was for you, what drew you to Christ, what called you into the life of faith. Often it's a mentor whose inspiring example and clear faith enfold us, a parent or a grandparent, a Sunday school teacher, an inspirational youth leader, a minister, a friend. And we're drawn and won over, impressed and challenged. And here we are now. Or it can be a moment when truth touches our soul, and with a word so true, a touch so certain, we are won over by the Christ, whose sacrifice, whose forgiveness, whose love brushes against our pain, and he throws his arms around our life and lifts us up, and we feel like we've been born again. No flashing lights, no unexplained experiences, but something so right, so real, and we are his, and we want to be. And here we are. Or maybe it's the quiet influence of years and places, people and music, a whole catalogue of connections and insights, so that almost unnoticed the grace of Christ filters into our heart, and there's no one we want to be other than who we are, a Christian at the very core of our being, and we hardly know how to explain it, how it happened, but we know it's true, and we want it to remain true. So that sometimes when we sing a hymn, it's like a soothing, cooling balm on our troubled hearts. And sometimes we feel our hearts strangely warmed, and we know in ways that words don't explain that he loves us with an eternal love. And here we are. For of course, hand in hand with that responsibility to think clearly, fairly and rigorously, is the responsibility to choose what to do with the truth when we meet it, know it, recognise it, acknowledge it, accept it. It's that glorious freedom to think and to choose that makes us human. Without that freedom, we are diminished. This is a huge blessing and a profound responsibility.